All right, so our testimony. Testimony is really just a firsthand account of how we came to know Christ. Very powerful. Especially in our culture, where our culture doesn't focus, you know, the postmodern perspective isn't on the correspondence view of truth. The truth is what corresponds with reality. You could really summarize postmodernism in the sense of incorrigible beliefs. An incorrigible belief is a properly basic belief. It's basically saying something like, it seems to me that that table is white. That has to be true. It seems to me, I'm the one who's sensing it, I can't be false. So postmodern people agree with incorrigible beliefs, and what's interesting about this concept of giving your testimony to people is that it really can't be disagreed with. Postmodern people, by their own worldview, have to accept that you had some kind of an experience. Now, we know this isn't to say that this is antithetical to truth or antithetical to reason or evidence. We have that in our toolbox as well. This is just to say that this can really touch and resonate with postmodern people. It's definitely biblical. We see the Apostle Paul appeal to this in an evidential way multiple times in his ministry. Think of Philippians 3, where he's talking about what his life was like before Christ. He calls those things dung compared to Christ. Galatians 1, chapter 1, verse 11 to 24, really fits into the argument of Galatians. Paul's arguing that he has the true gospel. How do we know that? Well, he gives his testimony. Why would a Christian killer, somebody who hates Christ, have a complete 180-degree turnaround? Well, he says it's because Christ appeared to me. I had a direct revelation of Jesus Christ. And of course, we see Paul's testimony come up no fewer than 3 times in the book of Acts. Think about that. Talk about a way to emphasize something through repetition. Acts chapter 9, Acts chapter 22, Acts chapter 26, trying to show the importance of Paul's testimony. Keys to a good testimony. Testimonies aren't just for baptisms. We know this. Usually when you're talking to somebody who doesn't know Christ, there's times where you hit what you might refer to as like a roadblock, where it just seems like the conversation is grinding to a halt, and this is a good time to share about what Christ has done for you. The goal is to keep it short. Nobody except for your mother, maybe, wants to hear you talk for 10, 20, 30 minutes straight. We're thinking 2 to 5 minutes, where you're just sharing what the Lord has done in your life. The key to a good testimony is to keep your focus on God. It's good to share, you know, ways that Christian people impacted you, you know, teachings, friendships, and so forth. But we really want to make sure that we think this was God. God was the one who was drawing me. God was the one who was doing something in my life. I didn't used to be like this. Now I'm interested in God. There's a proverb that we like to share. It's that you share, you don't declare. This is kind of pandering to the postmodern perspective. Postmodern people are into sharing your experience. Let's hear your story. They're not into debate. They're into dialogue. And so this is basically a way to just share, well, this is what happened to me. We want to be extremely sensitive, using certain words that people don't understand would be inappropriate. It actually turns people off when we start to use Christianese, that strange language that only Christians speak. The whole point is we're trying to help them to identify with our experience rather than alienate them. And so here's a really basic framework for giving a testimony. I feel like it's helpful. Before Christ, meeting Christ, and after Christ. So BC and AD, you might think of it like that. Here's some questions I find helpful. Maybe you're thinking through, now of course you're not doing this on the spot. The point is that you know your testimony and you know it so well that you can answer all of these right on the spot. Or maybe you're trying to teach somebody how to give their testimony. These would be questions you could ask them to get them thinking. What did you struggle with the most in your worldview before you met Christ? What kind of doubts did you struggle with? What was your emotional state? How were you feeling? What was life like? What were you wrestling through? What happened in your life that led you to start thinking about Christianity? There could have been some key points, you know, forks in the road, where it was a moment where I felt like I started to look into this. During that time, you know, what were some of the ways that God was trying to reach you? These are all important questions to consider. Now, for each of these, you might not have an answer, but it kind of gets the memory jolted to start to think about, yeah, what was it before Christ? Secondly, meeting Christ. We don't want to skip this part. The Campus Crusade, said that in their four spiritual laws, people believed in the first three, 90% of Americans. You know, God has a plan for your life, there's a separation, Jesus paid for that. But then the fourth spiritual law was the need to receive Christ. 90% of people had not heard about that part. They'd heard Jesus died for my sins, sure, but they hadn't heard the part, I need to receive it. So when we talk about meeting Christ, we need to start asking questions like this. What was it that finally clicked that I decided, oh man, I need that. I need to personalize that decision. Specifically, how did you do it? For me, I'm pretty sensitive about how I share this part. It's kind of like the gospel authors. They're not going to be speaking falsehood. They're not going to be speaking untruthfully. And yet they might choose to focus on one part rather than the other. You know what I'm saying? So for some people, I'll share, you know, I was really depressed, which was true. Having an existential crisis, which was true. And then having the need to come to know Christ, and then the peace of Christ, what that was like. For other people, I share the part that I was stoned at the time. Stoned out of my mind, actually. For some people, that would be offensive. They would be, I can't identify with that. So I want to share something that I think the person can identify with rather than alienate them. Where were you when this happened? What did you pray? Being able to explain what you prayed at the time. What did you feel when you came to Christ? I've talked to some people. I remember hearing the story of my buddy leading his friend to Christ behind his apartment complex. And they're sitting in the car. He's like, you know, you could do that right here. You don't have to come to church or anything. Just, you know, turn to Christ in your heart. And so he did. He prayed with him right there on the spot. And afterward, he said amen. And his buddy looked up and he went, man. My friend was like, what do you feel like? And he goes, feels pretty good. Couldn't quite put his finger on it, but he's like, wow, something's different. I've heard some people that were totally joyful, ecstatic. They felt the love of God, Romans 5:5, rushing into their heart at that moment. I didn't feel that way. Maybe you felt differently. I just felt a sense of peace. I just felt like a sense like that was the most important decision that I've been putting off my whole life. It was hanging over my head. It was right there, and I finally solved that, and it's done. Oh. And, you know, it wasn't like there weren't problems. There were still problems in my life, but it would kind of be like if, you know, you got a debt with the IRS of $200,000 wiped clean, and you come out of the IRS, I don't know if they have buildings, but you come out of the IRS building, and you walk to your car, and you see that you got a ticket. You're like, I don't like that ticket. But man, that's not going to ruin my day because I just got forgiven of this huge debt. And I think the same thing is true. We often talk about, you know, new believers get that spiritual high, and there's nothing wrong with that. And I think it should be embraced, talked about. Something must have felt different. What's interesting is that the apostles in the New Testament never appeal to felt needs. They never say, well, you're feeling sinful, or you're feeling a lack of purpose, or you're feeling this, you're feeling that. They just declared, this is true. You need forgiveness, whether or not you feel it. Yet, I have to believe that once you come to meet Christ, there should be feelings. Yeah, maybe not immediately, maybe not uniformly, that everyone has the same feeling. But there must have been something that you experienced. And so that'd be meeting Christ. What about after Christ? What in your life began to change? What was different than before? This is really encouraging to share with a non-believer. Non-believers are thinking, well, if I come to Christ, that I'm going to have to, you know, grow a mustache and wear a plaid everywhere I go, start watching PG movies, listen to the Fish radio station, you know. They're just picturing it's going to be bad. I don't want that. And if you can start to share, man, my relationship started to get healed. I had a close friend. Our relationship was on life support. God started to work on us. Now we're closer than ever. I was free from this addiction. I was free from that. I got to, you know, I was morbidly insecure. I was painfully shy. And you start to share what started to change. Being honest, we never want to lie. We never want to make something up. The story is good enough itself. We don't have to fabricate anything. We don't want to give the impression that all of a sudden everything was healed and I'm all better. In fact, people identify more with the idea that you came to Christ and you're still a human being like the rest of us. Could be slow change. Sharing stuff like, you know, I used to have misconceptions about Christianity and now following Christ, those are totally bunk. I realize those aren't true and you can start to clear those up. Well, that might be a long version of a testimony there, but get the gears turning. Start to think about what would be appropriate to share, how long should I share, and what would be helpful to identify with the person. I've been asked this question quite a few times. What if you grew up in a Christian home? You don't have a testimony. Your testimony stinks. I talked to one girl and she said, yeah, I just feel like I don't get grace. I feel like I just want to go out there and party and sleep around and go wild so I can really appreciate grace. So I can have a good testimony. gross. Let's think about this. Let's think. Let's actually use our minds here. Hold on a second. Biblically speaking, some of the best believers grew up in believing households. Who is the Apostle Paul's best disciple? Timothy, by a long shot. Think of Philippians 2. Paul says nobody has this attitude of being selfless except for Christ Jesus. And then at the end of chapter 2, he says Timothy is the only one who is not concerned for his own interests, but for the interests of others. He's literally comparing Timothy to Jesus Christ. And Timothy was a mama's boy. His father probably wasn't in the picture. He was raised by his grandmother and his mother, Lois and Eunice. Grew up in a believing home. They used to teach him the Bible. They probably had the VeggieTales picture Bible for Timothy when he's a little boy. That's a little bit anachronistic, but you get my point. His grandmother, his mother raised him. And what was he supposed to walk around his whole life ashamed of that? What? No. Philosophically speaking, there's nothing wrong with learning a truth of any kind from your parents. In fact, on the order of 90% of the things that everyone believes were taught from their parents. Imagine if you're talking to a skeptic and he said, so you believe that the earth is round and not flat? Yeah. Oh, why do you believe that? You probably just learned that in your fourth grade science class. Guilty as charged. Yeah, that is where I learned it. It's also true. The genetic fallacy in philosophy is an informal fallacy where if you show the origin of a person's belief, you've therefore falsified their belief. Well, you only learn that because you grew up in a Christian home, or you're only a Christian because you live in a country with a lot of Christians, or you only, okay, that's probably true. That could be true. Let's just grant that. That doesn't mean that Christianity is false. Well, you only grew up with your parents, and that's who taught you that. Yeah, but the only reason you believe that, you could appeal to a number of different things that they learned from childhood. It's my view that for people who grew up in Christian homes, you should share times of doubt. Share times where it was difficult. Well, were you a perfect Christian little boy and Christian little girl your whole life? You never doubted. You never had dissonance. You never fell into sin. You never were a hypocrite. Nothing like that. What about sharing something like, you know, I used to be pretty self-righteous. You know how instantly a non-Christian person will be gravitated to that? I used to be self-righteous, and then I realized that I'm really no better than anybody else. Oh, so good. I used to be pretty hypocritical, to be honest. I was kind of a double-lifing in my faith, and non-Christians love that. Here's David Kinnaman. He's kind of the new George Barna. He's taken over from the Barna Institute, statistician, researcher. He writes this in his book, Unchristian, from 2007. He says, people aged 16 to 29 were asked what word they would pick to describe Christians or Christianity. 85% used the word hypocritical. So high schoolers all the way up until you're 30, when they think the word Christian, they think hypocrite. And you, my friend, somebody who grew up in a Christian home, you can leverage that to your advantage. I'm not talking about manipulation here. I'm talking about you were sinful, you were hypocritical, you were self-righteous, and why not share that part? Don't talk about your four-year-old conversion. Nobody cares, okay? I'm just going to be as frank as possible. Nobody cares. Well, then I came to Christ on the bed with my dad when we were reading the Bible together. Nobody cares, okay? Why talk about that? How about this instead? You know, I grew up going to church, but I really went through a period of doubt as an adult. I really surrendered my life to Christ when blank. What's wrong with that? Many people in our culture grew up going to church. They might not have grown up going to a believing, Bible-believing, gospel-believing church, but they can identify with what you're saying. I really went through a period of doubt. Immediately, you have identified with that person. I really surrendered my life to Christ when blank, and focus on that part. And you could talk about your recommitment. You could say, you know, I think I did come to Christ earlier, but I remember that being the time where it became very real to me. My point here is don't be discouraged. Don't be fearful. Just realize your testimony is just as good as anybody else's. Period. For those of you who are like, well, I wish I had there. You know, I share my testimony at work. I remember working with this woman, and I started to share about how Christ changed my life, and I started sharing, and she said, so were you into drugs? And I was like, yeah. Were you a big drinker? Yeah. Womanizer? Yeah. Yeah, makes sense. I realized she had just categorized me. Oh, so you were a druggy loser, and so you needed Jesus. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to put limits on the Lord, but I don't know how much my testimony really impacted her, quite honestly. Somebody else, maybe you sitting here, could have given your testimony. It could have resonated with her way more. I like Sean McDowell's approach. Talk about the ultimate church kid. His father is Josh McDowell. Josh McDowell has authored or edited over 70, maybe to 100 books on theology, apologetics, etc. His dad was probably the biggest name in evangelical Christianity since 1975, and he's the son of this guy. And he's also going into apologetics like his father. Got a PhD, now he's a professor. And I remember listening to him in a debate. It was him, and it was an atheist, or a Christian who had turned atheist. And Sean McDowell gave his testimony. And it went like this. He said, you know, I went through a really difficult time in my life. I just felt like I really hit rock bottom. I was despairing. I didn't know what the next day was going to bring. And then I turned age 6, and at church camp I came to know the Lord, and it changed my life forever. The crowd just ate it up. They just loved it. And it was like, it was kind of cool. Like he was just saying, yeah, I came to Christ as a kid, whatever. And embraced it, and was just, and then he went on to share, you know, I was in high school and I was really doubting, and he shares this really heartwarming conversation with his father where he said, Dad, I just don't really know if Christianity is true. And his dad didn't blink an eye, you know, Mr. Truth, Mr. Apologetics, Josh McDowell. And he just said to him, Sean, he said, you know, I just want you to find truth. And if you pursue truth and you find out that Christianity is false, then I'll honor that. And you're still my son. I still love you. And he was shocked by that response. He went to study it more. Now he's turned into one of the best, biggest bats in the Christian world today. We're going to get him at our institute this summer. You're going to love him. sharp as a tack, well-spoken, gracious. It's just the trifecta. You hear him talking to people who are antagonistic, and he's just sweet and kind, and they'll attack him personally. It's just like it rolls off his back like water off of a goose. This guy, I love him. And grew up in a Christian home. So, yeah.